just to meet somebody.
Inviting me. Okay, so I'm going to talk about what global expressivism is from my point of view, and I think I'm going to do it, well, establish four things. I probably won't be able to do this, but if all things go well, I will. The first thing is, I suppose my idea of global expressivism is a kind of radicalized version of what Blackburn is offering, but it's not quasi-realism. It's rather the idea that we're going to explain assertion in terms of these prior psychological states. The radicalized idea the radical thought is that this will apply to every domain of assertion. So I'm going to be an expressivist about every domain of assertion. So an expressivist about talk about value, talk about truth, talk about validity, talk about meaning, talk about cats and dogs, talk about quarks. Doesn't matter. We're expressivists about everything in every domain. The second thought is that that this kind of expressivism isn't going to be semantics. Typically, when people talk about expressivism, some expressivists think they're offering an alternative kind of natural language semantics, and the thought is it isn't semantics at all. If you think of expressivism as semantics, that's going to mess things up for you. For example, in the Frege-Gietzsche embedding problem, I think that is a result of thinking, oh, I'm trying to do semantics, so I better offer an alternative analysis of validity. What will that be? Oh, can't find it. Maybe. So a problem, Frege-Gietzsche embedding problem. Okay, so rather the thought is expressivism isn't semantics. What is it? Well, it's a kind of speculative cognitive science, but of a radical kind, one in which representation doesn't play any explanatory role. So that's the anti-representationalism, is that representation never plays an explanatory role in giving an account of what goes on in the production of sentences and assertions in any given domain. Even in the domain where we talk about representation and reference and so forth, there's no problem. There is representation, reference, truth, and so forth. But even in that domain where we talk about these things, representation has no explanatory role to play. So it exists, it just doesn't have that kind of theoretical role, representation. Here's the thought. The theory of meaning goes the way in which the theory or meta-ethical theories go. Just as you don't have a theory of what values are when you're a value expressivist, you don't have a theory of what meaning is when you're a global expressivist. It doesn't mean there are no values. I still want to be a realist. Just there's no theory about what their natures are. And there's no theory about the nature of meaning either. So that's the first proposal. Global expressivism is a kind of radical speculative cog sci. Second thought is, what was my second thought? Second idea is that it's not going to be a minimalist approach to it's not minimalism. So some people would say or might think that in order to get a global expressivism, I've got to buy into some kind of minimalism about truth, minimalism about reference and so forth. Okay, I just think that's false. So this is not going to be any kind of minimalism. In fact, I think minimalism commits us to a kind of representationalism and metaphysics, essentially, about truth and reference. So that's the thought. That's why I don't want to be a minimalist. I don't think that the T schema, for example, or these platitudes about reference and so forth have any explanatory role. Rather, it's the other way around. We explain the T schema or our dispositions to asserting instances of it and so forth by through a prior account of the function of the truth predicate, or what I call the language agency, the expressive analysis of what we do with the truth predicate will explain our dispositions to assert the T schema, not the other way around. Third thought is the bifurcation question. I want to show that once we buy into this idea of expressivism as a kind of speculative cog sci, and it's not a theory of meaning, we're not going to be driven to the forces that seem to drive us to posit this idea of a thick reference or tracking or thick representation as opposed to a thin representation isn't in operation anymore. So this version of it, so contrary to people like Hugh Price, I'm not going to have that. This idea that we've got to bring in, for example, for our talk about cats and dogs and middle-sized material objects, that we've got to bring in some kind of semantic or semantic grounding relation that links us to our subject matter is false. We don't need that. And what gets us to what makes us think we need it is that implicitly we think that our expressivism is a theory of meaning. It's ultimately giving us account of content, whereas this global expressivist picture is no. Actually, there's no theory about what content is ultimately. And once you've got that, you no longer have the forces driving you to posit this sort of thick representational relation, or this, let's say you might call it tracking or indicating and so forth. Anyway, that'll do. And I might make some remarks at the end about metaphysics. I suppose I think that the global expressivist picture just burns off the metaphysics. It's a kind of realism, but there is no metaphysics lurking there. In particular, let's say we're realists about meaning, realists about value, but there is no, as it were, metaphysical nature to meaning or value. And that's part of, so that's part of the reason why there is no theory of meaning. Because there's nothing for it to be about. There's no nature there for it to be about. There are meanings, they have an identity, but there's no sort of constitutive nature there for a theory to be something about, for a semantic theory to have as its subject matter. Okay. So begin with the basic idea that we're going to globalize expressivism. How is that possible? If we're going to globalize it, the following must hold. Expressivism for any domain D of assertion has got to be consistent with the assertions in that domain being genuine assertions, truth-apt, belief-expressing, and for that domain of talk to be perfectly realist. So in other words, expressivism's got to be consistent with realism, with truth-aptness, with cognitivism. In other words, it's got to be a cognitivist expressivism, it's got to be a realist expressivism. There's no inconsistency with that. Okay, so the question is, well, how could that be possible? Well, let's try and see. First, what's expressivism? Well, as I say, got there on the handout, first thing, I sort of extract the picture from, let's say, someone like Blackburn. It's a kind of explanatory doctrine. It's an explanation of what goes on in the production of sentences in some domain. And that, it has the following character, that you don't see people, let's say in the case of morals, producing the value sentences as entering into representational relations, their mental states entering into representational relations to the world. That's not how the explanation looks. Rather, it's one in terms of mental states, which are not truth apt states, not belief states. They're pre-doxastic or non-doxastic states. They don't, as it were, have representational relations to the world. And you express these states. Expression needs to be defined, to be theorized. You can't just treat it as primitive. So there's a specific sense of expression that needs to be deployed. Okay, so that idea of expression or expressivism, given there, I think is perfectly consistent with those sentences in that domain, nevertheless being cognitive, being truth apt, and so forth. It just means that the belief component or the truth aptness or the truth conditions don't have an explanatory role in telling you what goes on in the production of those sentences. Okay. Let's say we're going to be global expressivists. Okay, what are the states that generally get, what are these states that get expressed in the various domains of assertion? Well, let's just call them these states, because here we're going to get a bit theoretical. We're going to sort of move beyond folky ideas about mental states. We'll just have to introduce, to some extent, a neutral vocabulary. I'm going to call them pi properties. Why am I going to, or pi states? Why am I going to call them pi states? Because I'm already going to get a bit speculative. I'm going to be moving beyond a folk idiom of calling them beliefs or something like that. I'll call them pi properties. So what I want to do now is just sort of generally give an idea of what they might be like. So figure one is the thought. So this is how we're going to globalize expressivism. We're going to say, look, what goes on is we've got all these domains of assertion, and the assertions in the different domains will be, you might say, the states being expressed in these different domains will be based on different kinds of faculties of the mind, different kinds of capacities in the mind. And the different kinds of capacities are, well, affective aspects, perceptual aspects, manipulative aspects, inner state cognitive processing aspects, and another kind of aspect, I call it L processing. I'll get onto that in a moment. So here's your mind. You've got these different kinds of modules, and they correspond roughly to these different sorts of faculties or capacities. So take the basic case. You might have affective states. When I say something's good, the standard expressive story is, oh, well, I'm expressing an affective state. Okay. I'm going to say that's not, strictly speaking, correct. Our first move to a more globalized idea of expressivism will be that, well, you don't express per se an affective state. What you do is you express a state which is slightly more abstract. It's this pi property, which is generated, or which has as its canonical cause an affective state. So in other words, that little picture there is the idea that, well, look, affective states will give rise to specific kinds of these pi properties, a delta one. Okay, and it has a certain structure. Don't think of it as an affective state as such, but just something that is the output of that particular system, which is the affective state system. Why do I want to say that? Well, I want to say that it's possible that you can assert moral statements but not have the affect. You're just cool about it, you've never thought about it, but someone tells you and you believe them for whatever reason. So the thought is, in that case, you're tokening a kind of delta state, that specific kind of a delta state, which would or is typically or has as one of its canonical inputs an affective state, but you just don't have the affective state. Nevertheless, when you say that's good, i.e. this is what my parents told me, you are expressing that state. But you're not, as such, expressing an affective state, because you may not have the affect. You may actually be like a psychopath, not be motivated in a certain way. So there's a kind of leeway there, and that's good for expressivism, because often an objection to expressivism is that, well, you can assert moral statements but not have the affective state. Okay, so similarly, we need this, for example, if we're going to be expressivists about color terms, for example, I can say, and that's the next one along, I could say, well, the Chinese flag is red, but I've never seen it. I've just got this from testimony. So I'm not expressing a perceptual state when I say the Chinese flag is red, right? I've never been in that perceptual state. But what I've got is, what I'm expressing is a state whose canonical cause in me is a perceptual state. But I've just got that state through another route. The other route is ultimately through inference, or sorry, it's something that underpins inference and testimony. Similarly, causal language is ultimately going to be based on a module to do with manipulation. When you're a baby, you go around, you manipulate stuff. This is the ultimate kind of activity that is going to underpin your capacity to make causal statements. And again, the thought is that you don't actually have to have activated that particular manipulative orientation towards any particular events in order to make a causal statement. Rather, what you got is you're expressing a state whose canonical cause is that kind of manipulative activity. Clearly, it's going to be more complicated than that, but that's sort of roughly the idea. I've got this idea that these pi properties, which are theoretical entities which we're postulating, they've got a kind of structure to them, and that structure corresponds, let's say, to the subject predicate structure of simple sentences. So as I've got there, the canonical state generates this kind of something with syntactic structure, and that would be a mental state for the particular referring term concatenated with the mental, a specific kind of functional element corresponding to the predicate. Okay, so in the case of good, the predicate good, that predicate will have a certain, in a particular individual system, a certain kind of functional unit corresponding to it. And that's the kind of functional unit which, when it combines with a mental element with for a particular referring term, can be generated by an affective state that intuitively will be about the denotation of that particular referring term T. But that structured state can be generated independently of an affect state, i.e. when someone tells me that something's good and so forth. Okay, so that's roughly the picture of what we might call a cognitive or aspects of the cognitive noumenon. I'll call it a cognitive noumenon because it's a structure that underpins. We haven't got yet to talk about what the production of speech acts and symbols, which I'll call the cognitive phenomenon. Maybe I'll just quickly mention a few other kinds of things that I want to put in here. I mean, everything goes in here ultimately. Take cognitive state processing. I suppose that's going to correspond, the kinds of assertions that you're going to find there are things like statements of existence, statements of truth, identity statements. For example, an identity statement is a statement whose input's going to be, let's say, something like this, merging of files for referring terms. So when I say that, the morning star is evening star, what I'm expressing is a state which whose ultimate canonical ground is a merging of files for the evening star and the morning star, right? When I say that's true, I'm expressing a state whose canonical ground is a disposition, let's say roughly a disposition to assert the proposition. When I say P is true, I'm expressing a state whose canonical cause is a disposition to assert the proposition. It's a bit more theoretical than that, but that'll roughly do. And this allows also the fact that we make a distinction between the canonical cause and the pi property, the more abstract pi property, enables us to explain the fact that I can assert that things are true even though I don't know what the proposition is that I'm assigning truth to. So I can say what Fred said last night was true, don't know what it is, but that's fine because I can express this more abstract state whose canonical cause is an actual disposition to assert a sentence, okay? Validity, I mean, you're going to be an expressivist about validity, so what goes on when I say that's valid or that entails that is that I'm expressing a state whose canonical cause is a kind of transitional cognitive structure between these pi property states. Okay, that's pretty, you know, that's quite an abstract functional thing to be talking about. We don't have any immediate folk intuitions about it, but that's the thought. That what gives me the stability in my intuitions about inference and so forth? Why do I go for modus ponens? That seems pretty right. Or why does and elimination seem right? Answer, because ultimately what gives the stability to my logical intuitions is actual structural features of the, call them the seal or the cognitive law relations between various pi properties. We could talk about that in terms of a causal functional structure, but we can't go into that kind of detail here. Okay. Finally, meaning statements themselves are also expressively analyzed. What goes on when I say you're referring to Pegasus, or you mean that P for some P? The thought is, well, what would be going on in terms of activities when you, cognitive activities, by the way, when I use the word cognitive here, I'll mean just frequently just this, I just mean mental functional states, right? I don't mean cognitive per se in the sense of belief. What goes on when I make a meaning statement? Well, I think I'm roughly intuitively expressing states of understanding, okay? What do I mean by understanding? Well, I don't mean grasping meanings. I mean there's got to be a more abstract functional characterization of what goes on when I understand. And the thought is, well, what is understanding? Well, it's like perception. It's an independent module. When I listen to, you know, radio late at night, I can't help but interpret the words that come flooding into my mind. I've got no control over it. Can't turn it off. It's like perceiving colors. I can't help but perceive that that's red. I can't help but perceive that if, the meaning of if when someone goes if, in a certain context, right? So here's the thought. Well, we're going to postulate a kind of faculty, kind of capacity, kind of module, call it the L processing module. It's sort of like mirror neuron stuff in the sense that it's an automatic system that will, when I hear your words, it will do a kind of recapitulative act or internal process will go on involving the sort of lighting up of the relevant parts of the functional system to do with the production of that of a symbol. So when you go, if something lights up in here, that would be the speech act or the structure underpinning the speech act that I would produce if I were to say if. So what you're doing when you're saying, oh, that person's referring to that, is that you're expressing the states that are canonical, that have as their canonical causes output from this system. Okay, I'm going to talk about that system a bit more a bit later, but anyway, that's the thought. Okay, so broadly speaking, that's the picture, the kinds of states that get expressed across the board. So these correspond to, let's say, Hugh Price's sort of different kinds of functionalities. They just correspond to different features or faculties in the language system. This is perfectly individual basis. There's no reference to community or norms or anything like that. We're just talking about a functional system of a particular individual. So there's no reference to you expressing commitments or something like that. Don't want normative ideas of commitment to play any role. And it's not the case that it's always an affect state that you're expressing. It's totally non-affective states that are getting expressed. Okay, so now the thought is, okay, so let's buy into the idea that what you're doing is you're expressing these pi properties. Okay, but what makes it assertion? And where does belief come into this picture? Okay, why are these acts of expressing states assertions rather than something else? Okay. So, three possibilities I just want to briefly consider. So the thought now is we've got to explain our thought is, what is assertion? And in particular, take Hugh Price's book where he asks on facts and the function of truth, he asks, well, what distinguishes assertions from, let's say, orders? Right, so we really need to, you could say orders also involve expressions of states. So why is it that we call one bunch of speech acts assertions rather than another bunch of speech acts something else? Okay, so three theories, three ways you might go if you're expressively inclined. And they all of them, I will take them to be marriages with basically a Blackburnian orientation. The first marriage is a kind of minimalism, maybe a crisp and right minimalism about the assertoric, namely basically the class of truth app sentences, the assertion, or maybe assertions, are things meeting certain platitudinous conditions about syntax and regularity of practice. So we say all these things are all assertions because they involve expression of these states, but also you meet these minimal conditions. That's first idea. So Blackburn-Wright marriage. The second marriage is let's say, a Blackburn-Brandom marriage, where we say, and I think Hugh Price was talking about this yesterday, where the thought would be, well, what makes this assertion is that we've got a sort of basic Brandomian sort of analysis of assertion, and then we've got these expressed states tagged on to the Brandomian sort of neutral framework of assertion. There's that idea, that's the second idea. And then the third idea, which is one which I will like, is that, in fact, we've just got a more deeper theory about what expressing is in terms of cognitive, these noumenal cognitive structures. Okay, I'm not going to go into much detail on why I don't like these alternatives, but I suppose I don't like the right approach because I don't think disciplined syntacticism really captures what the truth apt is or what assertion is. I don't like the Brandon-Blackburn marriage because I don't think that... one, I've got reservations, the whole idea that you can explain assertion through inference. It seems to me inference is posterior to assertion. I don't see how assertion can be explained through inference. Secondly, it just seems to me that you've got two totally different ideas of expression going on there, the Brandom type idea and the Blackburn type idea, and I don't see how they're going to live together. So that's roughly why I don't like that approach. The third approach, which I like, is given in figure two, and here's roughly the idea. Maybe just go down from figure two to that somewhat arcane-looking diagram. Here's the thought. There's something right... the Brandom thought is really getting onto something, and it's the thought that, yeah, there is a connection between assertion and inference, but it's at a deeper level. It's this idea that, as I said, inference, what underpins inference ultimately as an activity is this relation between pi property states, and it's these, let's call them these cognitive laws that may link them, and these are the ultimate seat or ground for our logical intuitions. So the thought is that what's peculiar about assertion is that it is the manifestation of, or it is a speech act in which this architecture is manifested. It's specifically there, assertion is specifically there to manifest or express this architecture. Whereas speech acts like orders are not there to manifest this architecture. So, for example, the same mental state, let's say an affect state, can lie behind an order and an assertion. It's just that in the case of the assertion, what you're doing is expressing the structures, the architecture, as indicated there, for that mental state. And so, which is a desire, whereas you're not doing that in the case of the order. I mean, the intuitive idea is that you're defending the state. That's a folky way of putting it. So in the assertion, you're defending the desire. In the order, you're not. You're just manifesting the desire. Assertions are democratic. They sort of, you go in for a kind of potential interaction or dispute with your, in fact, sort of inviting it, whereas orders are autocratic. But that's going to be, that intuitive idea is going to be realized at a more sort of abstract background level in terms of this idea that you're manifesting this architecture. I try and spell that out with this idea of basic assertion. This is a bit of a toy theory. It doesn't really correspond to the full official picture, but But there it is. You produce a sentence S, and it's caused by a mental state phi. And in addition, and this is the defending part, and a disposition to produce, if prompted, symbols X caused by correlated elements gamma X in the C-law tree. That is more or less the structured tree in your mental cognitive noumenon that corresponds to, as it were, the system of justification ultimately for that pi. Though we shouldn't put it in terms of justification. We just mean the cognitive laws that are instanced in you, which ultimately cause the production of phi in you. Okay, that's... I'm just going to leave it there, that's somewhat sketchy. So that's basic assertion. That's not going to, as it were, give us full assertion, because it won't deal with the problem of insincerity and so forth. That's just more complication. So here's roughly the thought, is that assertions are going to be those speech acts that involve this kind of manifestation of this architecture of the cognitive structure for certain states. Question... What about sentences that are not being asserted? You just have to tell a causal story for those as well. But it turns out, when you do the details for this, that there's a common cause between a given asserted S, so for example, if you've got some reasoning like this, S, if S, R, so R, you've got S embedded and S asserted. And you might say, well, intuitively, we say, oh, well, there's a common content between them. It's the same. In one case, it's asserted. In one case, it's embedded in a sentence. And the thought is, well, actually, what's behind that intuition is that there's actually an interesting common cause between the production of S when it's asserted and the production of S when it's not asserted. And so this theory will explain that intuition that there is a common content there. And that's a good thing. Okay, what are beliefs in this picture? And I suppose here's the thought, here's the basic idea. I'm going to be a bit crude about it, but look at figure 2 of the picture on the left. The common view about assertion is, it seems to be this, that people have been thinking, I mean, this is the reason why people were non-cognitivists originally when they thought about expressivism. They said, oh, gee, what goes on when I say a moral sentence? Oh, I'm expressing a desire state. So I'm not expressing a belief state, therefore my utterance has no cognitive content, okay? That's the original picture. But that's assuming that belief, affect, judgment, and so forth are things that underpin assertion and explain assertion. And that if we're not going to choose, let's say, judgment or belief, and we choose affect instead, we can't, as it were, explain how our utterance is really a belief-manifesting utterance. But that gets the explanation around the wrong way. Actually, assertion, judgment, and belief are at a very similar explanatory level, and what lies underneath it is this cognitive noumenon of these pi property states, which can have a non-affective base or an affective base. So really, it's okay that all you believe, all your utterances expressing these underlying states can still be belief-manifesting utterances. There's no problem. It's beliefs at a different level. So what is belief? Well, the simplest theory, not one that I necessarily buy into, the simplest theory is, well, belief's a disposition to defend a pi property, right? It's got to do with this architecture. Belief isn't the state, phi, as such. It's rather this disposition to defend it. In other words, take the animals. The animals may have phi states, for example, pi affective states, for example, but they don't have, or they may have ones corresponding to perception, but they don't have belief. Why not? Because they don't have these further, as it were, and this is a Brandom-esque idea, I suppose, but sort of pushed down lower, they don't have this disposition to defend these states. And for that, you need symbols, more or less, a symbol level, the cognitive phenomenon. Okay, so that's sort of basically the idea. Okay. Frege Geech. So that's broadly speaking the picture, the kind of general structure. This is expressivism. How do we deal with Frege Gitsch? And I suggested at the beginning, the reason why we think Frege Gitsch is a problem is that we're trying to analyze what validity is, right? I think, or what incompatibility is. And this approach, the approach that I'm looking at, just doesn't do that. What it does is it tells you what goes on when you produce statements of validity. Okay. What is that? Well, you express something about your cognitive architecture. And that's so. In other words, when I look at a sentence like this, if lying is wrong, getting my little sister to lie is wrong. Lying is wrong. Therefore, getting my little sister to lie is wrong. Right. What does this speculative cog-sci approach to expressivism do? It says, well, it'll explain why you find that intuitively valid. So it'll one, explain what goes on when you assert that that's valid. Two, it will explain why you have that intuition, which will be to do ultimately with its postulations about the structure and the underpinning C-law relations, blah, blah. Three, it will tell you what goes on in the structure of those sentences in terms of their speech act structure. It involves these acts with a certain causal etiology, and that's fine. And that will be the same story, essentially, for all kinds of arguments. It doesn't matter what the pi properties are, whether they're affect-based or perception-based or what have you. And that's the story, right? There's no theory of validity that needs to be offered. Okay. Okay, minimalism. This is not a minimalist approach. Why don't I like minimalism? You might think, oh, well, it sounds kind of deflationist to me, you might think, because, representation doesn't come in the story, doesn't play an explanatory role. Rather, we'll give a theory about what goes on when, a cognitive theory about what goes on when you produce statements of reference or representation, right? You might think, so what is reference or representation? Well, to some extent, that question disappears. Okay, so then you might think, well, then how is that kind of different to what the minimalist says? Okay, what do minimalists say? Well, typically they want to say, they say several things, but they want to say that ultimately, let's take minimalism about truth. They say the platitudes fix our concept. So how does that work? Well, I take it roughly to be like this. Somehow we utter all, or we're disposed to utter all these T sentences. Okay. So I'm disposed to utter all these T sentences. That somehow fixes my concept of truth, or my concept of truth resides in that disposition. Then somehow that concept picks out the property of truth. I have several questions about that theory. One, why isn't the minimalist theory of truth? It just seems to me truth's a property. It's out there. Gee, that's a metaphysical posit. What is it? Is it minimal? I don't know. We can't say much about it, but it just has a primitive nature, apparently. Can't reduce it to anything. Maybe our concept of it is minimal. It's a pretty boring concept. It's just there's something about the T sentences. Doesn't mean the property of truth is minimal. Okay. So first worry. Second worry is, well, what goes on when I say what you said is true? It seems to me the property of truth is entering into the story about what goes on when I say that certain things are true in a representationalist way. What I'm doing is I'm representing, or I'm, the minimalism seems to me to imply that I must be engaged in, when you analyze what I'm doing when I say that snow is white is true, I'm engaged in trying to represent a certain thing about a proposition, namely it's got the property of truth. You say it's the minimal property, I don't care, I don't know why it's metaphysically minimal, but that looks like a representationalist picture about what goes on when I produce truth sentences. That doesn't look like, well, it looks like representationalism. So that's why I don't like minimalism, because ultimately it just seems to me to commit you to a representationalist treatment of assertion in certain domains. And they don't like the implications of that for various reasons. And in particular, well, it's just giving up on the program of global expressivism. Same for reference. Okay. So that's why it's not minimalist. I think, so And in particular, I think it gets the order of explanation around the wrong way. For example, I think that it's because the truth predicate has in me a certain language agency, which is to say, I produce truth roughly, I'm expressing states whose canonical causes are these dispositions to defend properties, etc. That structure ultimately explains why the T-schema is so intuitive for me. Right, so the T-schema is posterior, it's not prior. Okay. Cool. Okay, so here's the next issue, which is my picture on the next page. And this is meant to be the issue of, well, representation. Isn't it going to crop up again when we think about our activity of assertion about, let's say, middle-sized material objects? Okay, this is won't we therefore have to, as it were, go beyond your expressivist treatment of reference or representation and so forth, and introduce this separate idea of representation? And I say, no, we don't have to. What makes us think that we have to is that we might still be thinking that we're offering a theory of meaning, but actually we're not offering a theory of meaning at all. Instead of offering a theory of meaning, we're offering a kind of functionalist treatment of assertive activity about meaning, right? That's what we're offering. And that's going to undercut any need or any possibility of a theory of meaning. That's the claim. Okay, but here's the thought that makes you think, ah, oh, but I need this other kind of representation. Call it representation. Maybe it's indicating, maybe it's tracking. Here's the line of thought. I think it's on the sort of summed up on the handout, but I'll put it this way. It might be this. Look, we interact with the world. There I am interacting with the world causally. That's ultimately got to play a role, somehow constraints, whatever, my practice, when I talk about cats or dogs or whatever. If I think I'm in the business of giving a theory of meaning, I might think, okay, so that interaction's ultimately got to constrain what I mean by dog. And that interaction is ultimately going to have to play a role in explaining why it is that we both mean the same thing by dog. Or that interaction has ultimately got to, as it were, fix the extension of the word dog in my mouth and in your mouth and so forth. If so, it's got to be, that interaction's got to be something, well, it's beginning to look like something that fixes reference. It's beginning to look like something that's sort of tied up with correctness conditions for the use of the predicate, for example, if we're thinking about a predicate. And that's looking like a kind of referential relation or something that's going to be pretty close to it. Bugger. So we've got to postulate this something that is, that as it were, is in the business. It's not, as it were, expressively. Okay. You may think, aha, we need this separate idea of representation, and that's going to be where the bifurcation idea comes in. Okay, my response to that is the following. You're just assuming that you're in the business of giving theory of meaning, but there isn't any theory of meaning. There is nothing that constitutes ultimately what you mean by dog. There's no theory to say, well, what is it to mean something by dog? There's nothing. There's no answer to that question. Because there has no, well, this is the metaphysical point, has no constitution. That might horrify you. You might go, well, oh, Steve, that's so absurd. And I say, no, I'm going to give you a consolation that once you've got it, you'll begin to learn to like it. You won't stay awake at night worrying about what constrains meaning. And it's this. The interaction with the world that we're talking about, this causal interaction ultimately, has input into something, and it does constrain something. What it constrains is the function of that faculty or that system, what I was talking about earlier on, the L processing system, that underpins your production of statements of meaning. So this is the sort of the mirror neuron idea that stuff lights up when I hear you, okay? That system is ultimately, and its function is sensitive to this relation, right? Or to relations between the mental, let's say there are, in the case of my dog picture, you've got the system that underpins your production of dog statements. That system's going to be a perceptual-based system, right? So my interpreting you and so forth, or anyone interpreting you, or you interpreting yourself, which will involve the activation of this L-processing system, a different system, it's going to be sensitive to, or its function's going to be partly causally modified by, the structure of what... The kind of sensitivity that we have here between your module to do with perceptual states, and in particular to do with the dog, the one relevant to dogs, and my attribution of meaning to you. So here's the thought. Sorry, that's a bit vague, but it's like this, that this L processing system, I mean, it's an empirical question, cognitive empirical question about how it exactly works, but the thought would be that it's going to work partly holistically. It's going to work through pattern recognition of various kinds, word-word pattern recognition, word-world pattern recognition, word, you know, belief pattern recognition. How does this constraint work? Well, roughly like this. Let's suppose that you have the perceptual module that underpins your use of dog is functionally identical to mine. Then that will mean, probably, ultimately, that there is a certain stability in how my interpretive system will light up in relation to your language. Right? That means that ultimately, I will be stable in the output will be stable with respect to you and your use of the word dog. Okay? So in other words, we're all pretty stable with respect to each other in terms of output of our L processing systems. When I say dog, you, as it were, intuitively give the same interpretation, right? So here's the thought. There's an interesting causal theory about stability of interpretation. Right, that's where the interest is. There's an interesting causal story to tell about the stability of interpretation. And that's where all the explanatory action is. There is no interesting story to tell about, as it were, there's somehow this sense of fixation of meaning by an underlying causal relation between bits of your brain and the world. So in other words, we're no longer saying, oh, gee, how can your thoughts be constituted? Oh, they must be constituted through some interesting relation between something in your head and the world, i.e., that must be an indicator relation. We're going from thinking that way, which is looking for the constitution of meaning, to looking this way. Ah, there's an interesting causal relation and causal story to be told about what constrains or what causally modifies the system of interpretation, or that, the cognitive structure that underpins it. There's an interesting story to be told about the relation between that system and ultimately interactions of other parts of the mind and the world. Okay, and that means, I think, the pressure is off for looking for this thing, looking for this relation that fixes extensions. It's no longer there. So in some sense, we can happily agree with Kripke. There's no fact of the matter about what fixes the extension of the word red. But there is an interesting story to be told about what goes on when I interpret you as referring to red. And that's going to be this speculative cognitive story about the L processing system and how it becomes stable in relation to other speakers given their architecture. But that's roughly the thought. Okay. And that's why I think... I've run out of time. That's why I think 5 minutes. we're not driven anymore to think that we need this other kind of representation. Okay, final thought, and that's really realism. I think this kind of expressivism is just, it's completely realist. It's just realist that there are moral facts of meaning and so forth, etc. There's a property of truth and so on. So you might say, oh, that's bizarre. What's the point of being an expressivist if I end up being a realist? And I say, well, you only got that feeling because you think this is meant to be the only way to deal with our anxiety about what meaning is or what values are is to get rid of values and meanings, right? That's why we make this contrast between the moral realist and the expressivist. Okay, that's not the only way to deal with the anxiety. In fact, there's another way. You keep your realism, but what disappears is the anxiety about what a value is. In fact, value doesn't have any nature. It's got an identity. I can happily talk about values. I can say, well, values are those things that we, seek, that motivate us, and that, if I say something good, then I ought to do such and such and so on. I can say all that. But then I don't, as it were, deal with the metaphysician's question is, but tell me, what's a value? Right? The best answer to the metaphysician is to say, well, it has no inherent nature. Go away. That's it. How's that? Well, roughly, that's my little... I'll do this in about 2 minutes. How does that work? How would you get rid of And it's there in three steps. How do you get rid of nature, as it were, or this need to look for it? It's this. Well, one, in explaining what goes on in producing value sentences, the referents of good, that is values, or things in terms of which they can be defined, have no explanatory role. Right? In the expressivist story that we tell, the referents have no explanatory role, or value terms have no explanatory roles. The explanation is purely in terms of the expression of affective states. First idea. Two, if values are anything defining them play no role in how we explain talk about values, then any hypothesis about what values are constituted by, any such hypotheses are void. All these hypotheses are false about what constitutes the values. Why is that? Well, because of the linkage principle. If we say O's are certain things, like values, O's, are things with constitution C, so let's say values are primitive properties with oughtness built into them, let's say, then if that's our view, then if we say O's are C's in that sense, there must be some place for the C's, in this case, primitive values with oughtness built into them, to play a role in the analysis of the production of talk about O's, the values. But there is no place for such things to play any role because the referents have been eliminated in that explanation. There's no place to put the primitive, weirdo things because the referents in the talk about value have been eliminated, explanatorily eliminated, but not existentially eliminated. We can still happily say, explain the talk about what we do when we go on and refer to values, not a problem. It just means that the metaphysical hypotheses, which are ultimately hypotheses about constitution, they all turn out to be false. Hence, values are without any inherent nature. Same thing for meanings. And I've already slightly gone over time, but I think I've done it. And that's it. Thanks.